Economists love to tell you that there are no $100 bills lying on the sidewalk. If there were, someone would have picked them up already. On this episode, I talk with an economist who thinks criminal justice is one of the places we've been stepping over them for years. In American politics, crime policy is almost always framed as a trade-off. If you want less crime, you have to be harsher. If you want more mercy, you have to accept more disorder. And that zero-sum framing is one reason the debate keeps cycling between crackdowns and backlashes, and between tough-on-crime and end mass incarceration. Jennifer Doleac has been studying the economics of crime and public safety for over a decade, and is now the Executive Vice President of Criminal Justice at Arnold Ventures. She's also the author of a new book, The Science of Second Chances, A Revolution in Criminal Justice. As a note, Arnold Ventures is an investor in the argument. In this conversation, we talk about the central trade-offs that still do exist, like those between privacy and public safety, and retribution versus efficiency, but also about the places the evidence suggests we've been fighting the wrong battles. And we keep coming back to a simple question. What would it look like to build a justice system that's designed to find positive-sum wins and to learn quickly when something doesn't work? My name is Jerusalem Demsis. I'm the founder and editor of The Argument, a magazine dedicated to revitalizing liberalism for the 21st century. On this podcast, we bring together everyone from socialists to conservatives in conversation over the most important issues of the day. For an ad-free version of this episode, you can become a subscriber at theargumentmag.com. Jen Doleac, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So we're here because you have a new book coming out, which is propped up beautifully on this table for us. The Science of Second Chances, A Revolution in Criminal Justice. Mm-hmm. What is that revolution?
The revolution is really bringing what I think of as just the scientific method to policymaking in the criminal justice space. So I'm an economist. Economics is relatively new to mm-hmm. the criminal justice field. I'd say, you know, there are some people who've been working on crime and criminal justice policy for a couple decades, but I got my PhD in 2012 and was really part of a really junior cohort at that time that people were trying to bring into the field, trying to convince that, like, this is an issue economists should be thinking about. Mm-hmm. And so in many ways, I'm like on the senior side of economists who think about this topic. And we're bringing just a different toolkit, really trying to tease correlation from causation, our obsession with causal inference, mm-hmm. as well as thinking about incentives and trade-offs and all those good things economists like to think about. So that different lens, really just, you know, trying things, testing them, failing fast, trying something else. That is the new approach that we're bringing to the criminal justice space.
And this book is in many ways like the culmination of years and years of research, both mm-hmm. from you and other economists, but also some criminologists, sociologists, et cetera, who have been involved in these matters. When you think about the before and after this sort of like economist revolution in criminal justice, like what is changing? What is new that you're bringing to this field that maybe before wasn't as appreciated?
Yeah, I think economists bring three things. Mm-hmm. So one is this, the theoretical lens that we're bringing is this interest in how people respond to incentives, a real interest in, you know, how to, if we want to change behavior, we need to change the incentives that people are responding to, thinking about trade-offs, all of those things, externalities. So that's the theoretical lens we're bringing that's just different from the way that sociologists and political scientists and public health scholars approach the world. Second is, as I said, our obsession with causal inference. Mm-hmm. So economists have over the years developed an empirical toolkit that really enables us to test whether something worked as if we were in a lab, mm-hmm. right? So really, there are a lot of places where we can run a randomized trial, and there are a lot of places we can't. And in those places that we can't just randomize some people into a treatment group and some people into a control group, economists are really good at finding natural experiments that approximate mm-hmm. that ideal lab experiment. So that's the empirical toolkit that we're bringing that is, you know, not completely different from how other fields approach this, but I'd say we're the most obsessive about mm-hmm. using that toolkit and you know, perhaps sometimes too dismissive of not using the toolkit. Mm-hmm. But we, you know, we can only publish papers that are measuring a causal effect. Mm-hmm. Other fields, there are people who really focus on those causal studies, but they can publish other stuff too. So we're the experts really on the, you know, are we really isolating the effect of this program or policy? And the third piece is, because we're really good at quantifying what the impact is, that feeds into our ability to do cost-benefit analyses to figure out, is this the best allocation of scarce resources, public safety dollars, staff time, whatever it is, in order to meet our goal? Mm-hmm. So whether it's reducing crime or increasing employment, whatever the outcome is, we're very good at helping decision makers optimize their allocation of resources.
So I you say this in a very, I mean, you're a very nice person and a very kind person. So in person, it's like, oh yeah, she's just bringing some causal inference into the field. But you reveal in the book this has been way more controversial than I think you're letting on right now. And I wonder, why do you think it has been? Because you've received a ton of flack from like all sides, a ton of flack from all sides of the political spectrum.
Yeah.
And at various points in your career. And I wonder, why is it so controversial to bring that kind of focus on causal inference, that kind of focus on, well, does this study actually replicate? Okay, you tell me it's really important to pursue X intervention, but now we have a study saying that doesn't actually do that much if we care about public safety or if we care about outcomes of recidivism or whatever it is. So why is that so controversial?
I'm not entirely sure. I still find it surprising that it's mm-hmm. as controversial as it is. I think part of the answer is that we live in a world where people very naturally kind of feel like they have to be on one team or another, mm-hmm. usually a political team or another. And if their political team is in favor of this policy, then they only will accept studies or research or arguments that are in line with that outcome mm-hmm. or that policy prescription. And that's just not how researchers approach the world, right? I mean, I think good researchers, good mm-hmm. scientists need to be open to being wrong and having their mind changed. And that's just not the standard public conversation. I think where it's been most surprising to me is where I'm getting that pushback from other researchers.
Yeah.
When did it happen? I think in those cases, you know, if it's pushback on the quality of the study, that's one thing. And those are the kinds of conversations we should be having in academia. The surprising pieces are where I think, in my view, the researchers are falling a bit or positioning themselves a bit too far on the advocacy side mm-hmm. And perhaps not trusting the public enough to be able to handle, you know, some information on this side, some information on that side, mm-hmm. and then like making sense of it and figuring out what to do. I did a study on naloxone as an intervention in the opioid epidemic several years ago now. And that was the one where I got the most pushback. I basically mm-hmm. found that a very popular policy was not effective
what
at saving lives. Increasing access to naloxone.
Mm-hmm.
And the public health research community was the one that came after me the most. And basically in conversations that I had, mostly online, some in person, what came out of that was, well, we know that naloxone access is good because mm-hmm. it saves lives. We should be saving lives in the moment when we can. I completely agree with that. But if my study is showing that this is not effective at saving collective lives, like over some long term, it's mm-hmm. not actually improving outcomes in a way that we're hoping it will, then that will just discourage policymakers from keeping this life-saving intervention available. And so like they can't handle thinking about these trade-offs. They mm-hmm. we only can afford to have evidence that is like on one side.
Mm-hmm.
And I just found that so cynical and disappointing, because every policymaker I talk to is a pro at weighing costs and benefits. Like that's what they have to do all day long.
I don't know if that you're putting on your Arnold Ventures hat now, where you used to be nice to all the people
Maybe
you work with.
A selected sample.
But honestly,
it's like policymakers have to balance their budget. They mm-hmm. have people coming at them. One's asking for this, one's asking for the opposite. They have to be thinking all day long about like, okay, not everybody is going to be happy with me. I have to just make a decision.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's just a very standard part of the job. And so the idea, during this conversation, like I would have these really good phone calls with policymakers about like, okay, well, what do we do about naloxone policy? And it's like, well, it's complicated, right? Mm-hmm. I think the what the study is showing and what our research so far suggests is that this intervention is not solving the problem, right? Mm-hmm. It's an intervention point. You can save that life in that moment. That's amazing. You should totally do that. But you need to really start working on finding other solutions to addressing mm-hmm. the larger problem, because this isn't going away.
I think that's actually the exact point why people get so upset about this. Because I see this sometimes too, where like, you know, a study will get published that pushes against a prevailing wisdom mm-hmm. in a, whether it's an activist space or academic space even, or policymaking space. And people get very concerned, I think often not because they themselves can't agree that like there might be studies published that undermine the value of what you're trying to do, but it still means the thing you're doing is still valuable. It's just like slightly less valuable in a certain context.
Right.
But I think they're worried about how other people react to it. It's like a fear that like, okay, what if other people read this research? And maybe it's the only thing they read, because I have, I think, more pessimistic view of policymakers than you do. Not because I don't think they have to juggle a lot of stuff, but because I think most people struggle at thinking through trade-offs. Mm-hmm. I think having to do that systematically as a part of your job every day where the stakes are so high, you're going to make a bunch of mistakes.
Sure.
Even,
you don't have all the information.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But even just like, I think people often use heuristics for making decisions that are mm-hmm. quite bad and quite clear that they're not actually thinking about the trade-off of what they're doing.
Yeah.
But as a result of that, like, I do get worried about this. I mean, in the housing space where I spend a lot of my time, mm-hmm. You know, there are, you know, certain individual papers that push against the idea that building more housing is a good outcome and or that will help address the housing affordability crisis. And policymakers will just trot, I mean, I cannot even, will trot out the single paper. I mean, like, Yonah Freemark, he's a great guy, but he has a paper out that, like, undermines the case for upzoning. And I see this trotted out constantly by policymakers. It's like, despite the fact that 99% of the field and outcomes say something different, there's, like, now a question, there's a debate now about whether this is actually a good outcome. So I actually think that sometimes that, I worry that sometimes it actually is rational to behave this way, to, like, to worry in a, that you need to actually really push back against this, but I think it's really bad. You're right when it comes from academic truth-seeking communities, because for them it's like, you know, your goal should always be like, what is true and good research and finding out accurate information.
Just wanting more information
exactly.
out there. Yeah, I mean, I think so. We get this in the criminal justice policy space too. You know, there are plenty of advocates out there, and most people in the policy space are taking that more team-based approach. They have a preferred policy. They go looking for research that supports that policy position, and they present that research, right? And that's not the way I would approach things, but it is definitely common. And so there are situations where we see that there is one paper that's out being trotted around. We disagree with the findings for some reason. Sometimes it's just, you know, it's one paper and there are 20 others that say the opposite. Usually there are real flaws with the research design, and that's why it found such a different result. And so we do talk a little bit internally on my team at Arnold Ventures about, like, should we have an FAQ about this one paper or something? Like, what are our talking points? Just so our advocacy team knows what to say. But I mean, the way we, so I mean, certainly we've not solved this problem, and this is a bigger question about just like culture change in government.
Yeah.
But I think the solution here is just to make everyone more competent consumers of research and knowing what to ask, right?
Yeah.
Because if the policymaker who's saying, well, what about this study, doesn't actually care about the study, then it's just a meaningless conversation. It's not worth our time. But I think often, at least the policymakers we're talking to, they genuinely do want to know what would the impact be. And these people are telling me it's this, and you're telling me it's something else. So how am I supposed to make sense of this?
Yeah.
And so then helping them work through, like, well, here's why I trust these studies and not this one.
Mm-hmm.
I have found to be effective. And the question is just, how on earth do you do that at scale?
Yeah. So I want to turn more to the content of your book, because you essentially go through a ton of the research that you found on, you know, it's actually like a variety of different aspects of the criminal justice reform space. I think it's useful to start where you do, which is you start with the DNA databases, because I think it presents the big trade-offs that we're all wrestling with around privacy and safety and et cetera. So walk me through your research on DNA databases. You find that they has a massive impact on recidivism.
Yeah. Yeah. So DNA databases are used by law enforcement. Basically, if you are arrested for or convicted of certain crimes, you're required to provide a DNA sample. These DNA samples are really just used to come up with a unique identifier. So it's like a hash social security number. It's not, they're not coding your whole genome. I think a lot of people think it's that. And then that string of numbers it produces is useful only for matching to crime scene evidence. So you put your ID, that your DNA number into the database. It's constantly comparing with the crime scene evidence, and it basically produces leads in cases where police don't have a suspect yet. So this increases the probability that you'll get caught if you reoffend for people who are added to the database. And so the question then is like, well, does that actually improve public safety? The hope is yes. Mm-hmm. We don't actually know. That's an empirical question. So the way I approach this is, you know, you need a natural experiment because it's not random who goes in the database, right? It's people who are typically convicted of more serious offenses. And so they might have a different recidivism trend than other people. And so what I was able to do is use the implementation dates of these laws. So if Kansas expands its database to add people arrested for robbery as of April 1st, then I can compare everyone who was arrested for robbery April 1st and later to people who were arrested for the same crime in the same states before April 1st.
Yeah.
And those people are identical in every way. It's very unlikely that, you know, criminals are timing their arrest based on these law changes. They don't really know about them. Everything else about the criminal justice system is the same through that period. But there's a sudden shock to the probability that the people who commit their crime or arrested slightly later go in the database. Their probability of getting caught if they reoffend has now jumped.
Yeah.
So what happens to their behavior? And so with this beautiful kind of natural experiment, this big discontinuity there, you basically see that recidivism drops for those people who are arrested just after April 1st. And this is, you know, I found this in the U.S. context, found this in the Danish context where we had much better data because Denmark has beautiful data that every researcher loves. And found especially that it's even more striking, the effects are larger for younger offenders. So so the evidence is sort of growing here also that like catching people or putting them in the database earlier in their criminal career when they really can change course is really helpful. So now my team at AV is now working to try to help states expand their databases to include people arrested for felony offenses.
So this line of research, I think, raises a couple of questions for me. The first is, I mean, it raises the big debate or the big finding in the criminal justice space around certainty of punishment.
Yeah.
Tell us about that, because I think that's actually not intuitive to most people.
Yeah. So you know, the sort of standard economic thinking about this is people who are considering committing a crime are comparing the cost and benefits, right? And the cost of committing crime is the probability that you get caught times the punishment. And there's some benefit that you get from committing the crime. And so if you want to reduce the number of people who commit crimes, you want to increase the costs or reduce the benefits.
Yeah.
Like that's how you change the incentives. So one way we could increase the cost is to make the punishment harsher or longer. The other way is to increase the probability. And Gary Becker, who originally kind of came up with this, noted, especially when you're thinking about traffic tickets, well, you could catch fewer people, but have it be a much bigger ticket. And that actually would get you just as far as catching everyone with a small ticket. And that's probably true for some of those kinds of offenses where people are, you know, really forward looking and you're talking about money or something. But it turns out in general, that is just not true.
Yeah.
That those things are not equally powerful when you pull on those two levers. And the reason is most people who are on the margin of committing crime are just not thinking very far ahead. And so increasing the probability of getting caught and facing any consequences in the very near future matters a lot more for someone's decision making than keeping the current still low probability of getting caught, but adding additional years to their possible eventual sentence. No one's thinking past today, maybe this week. At making it a 1 year sentence versus 2 years versus 10 years is just not entering into the calculus at all. And so this is coming up again and again in lots of different domains, that if we're able to move up the consequences and increase the the certainty with which someone is going to face those consequences, we see behavior change really fast and really effectively. And so we can use that very much to our benefit.
So like if you're going to commit a crime, you need to know that you're going to get caught. It's not just like, oh, if I get caught, it'll be 20 years.
Right.
I mean, I think the thing that's really operative in what you just said, too, is like the types of people who commit crime. Because when I first learned about this kind of paradigm in criminal justice, I was sort of like, well, you know, I know in the transit space, right, like really well operating transit systems often don't collect fares at the bus because it's so costly to like wait, pause, and then everyone taps in or gives the conductor or their operator the money or whatever. So what they do is they actually have someone randomly go around to buses and check people's tickets. I was like, well, in that context, we know that like it's way more like you reduce the cost that the system has to bear of you know, reliability of the bus, how long it takes a transit operator, whatever. But also, most people will comply and just buy the ticket because, like, it's
you. It would be really embarrassing to be the one person that's caught.
And the fine is pretty high. You do that too. Yeah. I'm like, well, in that context, it works. But, like, the thing is, the set of people who ride a bus are not equivalent to the set of people who are on the verge of potentially committing a crime. So, who are these people and why are they so susceptible to this kind of logic?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of research just kind of testing what economists call discount rates for people who are in jail or in prison.
And what is a discount rate?
A discount rate is basically how much you discount the future. So we all care a little bit more about our happiness today than we do about our happiness next week or in 10 years, largely due to just the uncertainty of like there's lots of stuff that could happen between now and then. But people who are involved in the criminal justice system have much higher discount rates. They discount the future much more than the average person does. And there's one paper that even like sorts it out by different types of crime. And they're just like some types of offenders, just like it's like they're discounting like almost completely, like nothing past today. And others are a little more forward looking, which is just kind of fascinating. But so that means that, the whole game is like, how can we help them see the payoff of good behavior really quickly, but also face the consequences for bad behavior really quickly. And the reality is like, that's just the opposite of the way we currently structure our criminal justice system. And I think part of the reason for that is that for legislatures that are worried about crime in their states, the main lever they have control over is sentencing policy.
Yeah.
And so they can increase sentences. Like you can just pass a law and make sentences longer, increase the sentencing guidelines, whatever. It is harder to legislate solving crimes faster. Like that is something you're going to have to like kind of figure that out. That's through the police. It's through law enforcement, better investigation tools, more funding of forensic labs. I mean, there's stuff the legislature can do, but it's not as easy as just like, we'll just write into the law. It's now 10 years instead of five. But the reality is that those sentencing reforms do not work to change behavior on the front end. They are extremely expensive because prison's really expensive. So keeping people in prison for longer with no public safety benefit is just a waste of tax dollars if what we want is less crime. And so we're going to have to like help legislatures figure out how to use the toolkit they have to focus on this increasing certainty angle instead.
How do you figure out someone's discount rate?
I want to know question. Mine. Yeah, right. I think these people were using. There's some researchers that were using a couple of different reforms. There was a big. There were several. I think actually mass pardons in Italy over several decades, where suddenly they let out like 40% of prisoners because the prisons were so overcrowded. But then they would have some sort of incentive where like, if they got arrested for something new, they'd have to serve that new sentence, but also whatever was remaining on their previous sentence. And they all got released with different amounts left. So I think they were able to use those differences to see how much did that deter behavior forward.
Okay. Yeah. That's so interesting. I think that this also raises, though, like this specific paradigm raises like the privacy concerns, right? Because like you could have a system, right, that was like, or you could imagine a theoretical system where like, okay, we're going to create a panopticon. And like the second that you commit any crime, you will immediately have like a drone drop on you from above waiting to get you. And we obviously don't want to live in that world, in part because we're afraid of the way the government would use that kind of technology or kind of access to do unethical things.
Yeah.
But I think even holding that concern aside, like people were pretty confident the government would never do anything like that.
Yeah.
People don't like the idea of living under that kind of panopticon. I mean, yeah, obviously it depends country to country. Like, as you mentioned earlier, Denmark has a much better mm-hmm. data for researchers to work on because they've gotten more comfortable with getting that kind of information from their citizens.
Yep.
In the US, it's very difficult often to get the kind of data you would want in order to run the kind of research that you do.
Yeah.
And because we have, I don't know if this is true, but there's a belief that there's a really strong presumption towards privacy.
Yeah.
And I wonder, how do you weigh that as an economist who's mostly yeah. focusing on the crime aspect? But also, B, like, do you find sometimes that, like, you're doing your research, you're looking at the specific question, does it raise or decrease the outcomes you care about? And then you realize we're actually running into a wall here because the actual question is about values that, like, economics can't answer. So,
Yeah, I mean, it kind of also goes to this point that makes economists really unpopular at cocktail parties, which is just like the optimal amount of some bad thing is rarely zero,
yes.
right? So the optimal amount of crime is not zero yeah. because to get to that level, you'd have to have like cameras in your bedroom and like, yeah. No one wants to live like that, right? So I mean, the way I think about research in this space and you're right, like the DNA databases are like lots of different police tech or the kinds of tools that would increase certainty, where really the whole game is like keeping better tabs on people.
Yeah.
Right. Like that's how you increase the certainty of getting caught is watching their behavior more closely. And so these are all they're coming with some financial costs. Those are easy to quantify. Some privacy costs, which are very difficult to quantify. But I find it useful to at least be able to quantify the benefits mm-hmm. so that we can then have a more informed conversation about whether they're worth whatever we perceive the cost as. And then I think it's also useful to point out that two things. One is that there are probably things we could do to mitigate the privacy costs. Think about how long the data are retained, mm-hmm. who has access to them. Just have really strict guidelines and be really transparent about that to citizens. Yeah. But then the other thing is, the counterfactual here, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, what we would do instead is not that we all have complete privacy. There's probably something else we're doing to reduce crime instead. The alternative is put a police officer in every street corner, mm-hmm. lock people up for a really long time,
yeah.
right? Or have cameras everywhere. I mean, the alternative is just no one is ever watching us and we're living completely unfettered. It could be worse.
Well, it's a tolerance for higher crime, which I wonder sometimes.
Or a tolerance for higher yeah. crime, right. And so this is a place where I think just having the evidence, like the impacts on recidivism from DNA databases, also from cameras, mm-hmm. other kinds of tools like this, they're really big.
Yeah.
And so there's the idea that like, I mean, in the Denmark study, we're finding adding someone charged with a felony, especially these younger offenders or earlier in their careers, you reduce recidivism by like 40%.
Mm-hmm.
That's huge. Like most of our policies do not work
yeah.
at all, right? And so if you're getting that much of a public safety benefit, then I think it is, you know, that's fine if people say not worth it.
Mm-hmm.
But I do want to just have the informed conversation and say like, that's how much you're leaving on the table.
Yeah.
And crime is just really costly to society. And so, especially violent crime. And so if we have a way to, by solving crimes more quickly, be able to reduce the amount of violence in communities, that is really helpful to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want people to be really thoughtful about whether they want to pass that up.
I think on this values question, it comes up a lot in the criminal justice space because most people I talk to who are working in the economics of criminal justice, mm-hmm. they seem to implicitly not care about retribution. They seem to like, they have yeah. this value where they don't really care about like, we really got to punish this person because they did a bad thing. They're mm-hmm. mostly just thinking about how do we prevent this person from doing bad things in the future?
Yeah.
And how do we prevent other people from doing bad things because they've learned it's easy to do bad things? They don't, yeah. they're not like, oh man, like you stole and we really need to punish you for stealing yeah. or whatever crime it is. And I wonder if sometimes this is like a failure on the part of economists that like you guys just attract a set of people that like have values that are quite out of step, I think, with the average person, because most people don't actually feel that way. They're
yeah.
like, oh, even if the appropriate deterrent level for, I don't know, like assault was like 1 year in jail, and that's all you needed, and then you could save a bunch of money on the 19 extra years you're mm-hmm. putting someone in jail for, they go like, but that's a bad person and yeah. they need to be in jail.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah. This comes up a lot as you might expect in conversations with policymakers. Yeah. And I walk through it in the book too, just sort of, it's like, okay, it's useful now to step back and think about why we punish people. Because mm-hmm. I agree. I think most of our disagreements about, you know, should someone be in prison for 1 year versus 20 years mm-hmm. does come down to this values question of how much retribution versus mercy do they deserve.
Yeah.
And you can see this most clearly when we're thinking about how to handle young men who are caught mm-hmm. up in the criminal justice system, right? The highest risk group, if we're thinking about who's most likely to commit crime, especially violent crime, young men,
really like high under 25,
really high discount rate, doing a lot of like dumb and reckless stuff when yeah. they get together, especially if they're drinking, right? So the smart on crime approach, if you're just looking at what's the most effective way to reduce crime, would just be to like lock up all the young men until they turn 25 and then we can like start letting them out.
And there's like no crime.
And there's like no crime right now. Yeah. But it's like there's obviously a reason we don't do that. Yeah. We think, you know, people are young, they make mistakes, we want to have mercy on those people.
Also, like, most young men don't commit crimes.
Yeah. And, yeah. Well, yeah, and this may or may not be the most cost effective yeah. strategy. Prison's really expensive, et cetera. But part of it is also we tend to view youth as a mitigating factor.
Yeah.
It's like, well, they didn't really know what they're doing, et cetera. So we do this all the time. So when I talk to policymakers about this, I do try to set this up as, you know, we punish people, we put people in prison for a variety of reasons. We hope it has a deterrent effect, an incapacitation effect. You're actually like taking them off the streets. They mm-hmm. can't harm the community anymore. We hope it might rehabilitate them. It's an intervention point. And then there's also retribution.
Yeah.
Data and evidence can say a lot about those first three, mm-hmm. right? Like anything about, you know, is this actually improving public safety? Someone with my skills can help you understand if your policy is effective in that way and how much bang for your buck you're getting. My skills cannot in any way help you determine how much retribution someone deserves.
Yeah.
That's a conversation for you and your church mm-hmm. and like, you know, with your family, whatever. That's a question of values and morals. I certainly have opinion, like I have my own preferences, but there's no reason you should view my preferences as like better than someone else's. We all mm-hmm. just have different preferences. And so even if we all have the same information about what the public safety impact is, we might make different policy decisions because like we're weighting that public safety versus retribution piece differently. Mm-hmm. And that's totally fine. I guess the economist in me, and I think most economists would just say, you tell me what your objective function is and yeah. I'll tell you how to maximize it, right? We're not going to tell you your preferences are wrong. It's
Why
just
not?
A matter.
Sometimes, no, but like, seriously, I actually think this is one of those things where I'm like, I mean, I do think some preferences are wrong. Like imagine like what you said about locking every single young man yep. up in jail from the ages like 15 to 25.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm pretty sure you could eliminate like at least 50% of crime if like every single young man was just in jail.
Yeah, yeah.
Like what you would say is like, well, that costs like X trillion yeah. dollars and that would cost a lot of money. And also,
and we value freedom.
Yes.
We value freedom and privacy in this country. And so we don't do that.
But I mean, yeah. I think that's a normative belief yep. that you're in. Yep. And I wonder like, do you feel like your normative beliefs are often sneaking into your research in ways that are maybe you don't even realize?
I mean, probably because I'm human,
yeah.
but I do think this is a place where economists, I think, do better than other social scientists in that all of our training pushes us to become really good devil's advocates and like
yeah.
looking for the holes in like anyone's argument and like we tear each other apart in seminars
yeah.
and so on. And so we learn over time to do that for ourselves too and really just be thinking about like, okay, what's the counter argument here? What else could possibly be going on?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, no one's perfect, but that's the goal and the ambition.
So I'm curious on retribution, though, about the known impacts of it. Because sometimes the retribution people make kind of a complicated argument. Mm-hmm. People who are really in favor of it. Well, they'll say, like, listen, it's not just that like we need to punish this person because they did something wrong. It's that punishment is a signal of, you know, society's values, and that which has in itself a deterrent effect.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, are there studies that, like, measure the amount of deterrence that comes from just, like, being really harsh on crimes? And is there a way of sussing
yeah.
that out? Because I mean, we're at an equilibrium right now where like most people understand that like if you were to commit like, you know, mass murder, like everyone would think you were really bad. And I don't
yeah,
really
yeah.
know if the 30, 50 year sentence has a huge impact on that. But like, have we looked
right.
into that?
Yeah. So this would be, researchers divide deterrence into two types. There's
mm-hmm.
specific deterrence, which is when we punish you, you realize like, wow, being in prison is really awful. I never want to be here again. I need to like reset my life so that I'm like on a different trajectory. So that's specific deterrence. General deterrence is what you're describing. Mm-hmm. Like, we all see that people go to prison when they rob a bank. And so we avoid robbing banks,
yeah.
right? Because we don't want to suffer that fate. And so yes, that's an empirical question that you can look at you know, you have a policy change, sentences get longer, do you see crime fall? And this is just another place where, like, again, the type of person who's on the margin of committing crime is not, they're not thinking about the 50-year sentence versus 30 years. Mm-hmm. It's just not factoring in. And so, especially in a context where our clearance rates, our solve rates at this point are, like, typically in the 50 to 60% mm-hmm. range for homicides, so it's a coin flip. If you're even going to get arrested for murdering someone, talk about, like, burglary, car theft, yeah. we're in, like, 10%, 15%. Like, we should all be stealing cars, right? Like, there's just, like, we're probably not going to get caught.
Yeah.
And so it's in that way, and especially if you're the kind of person who's discounting the future a lot, that 60-year sentence just isn't factoring it at all.
Yeah. I want to switch gears here a bit to these kind of, like, broader crime conversations that are happening right now. So, mm-hmm. you know, when I think about crime in criminal justice reform in the discourse, I think of it almost as, like, these are they have, like, almost an opposite relationship in public discourse. So, like, when crime is really high, no one wants to talk about criminal justice reform uh-huh. and trying to make sure that offenders are, you know, being treated with dignity and respect. And then when crime is really low, then it becomes acceptable to kind of have those conversations, which yeah. makes sense at some level. Like, your people's attention is kind of focused on what they view to
You're
be
scared.
The biggest problem.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And when I look back at, like, the, you know, the last, like, 20 years of, like, criminal justice reform discourse, right? So, like, yeah. we see in the, you know, in the, as the crime wave of the 90s, like, really crashes and, like, become cities become safer, everyone kind of feels comfortable, criminal justice reform is, like, really takes off in this time period. Mm-hmm. But it's what's weird about it is that it often ends up eating itself alive, right? Like, what mm-hmm. we saw occur is that people began supporting policies that ended up actually making it easier making crime worse. So mm-hmm. I mean, this was I don't know if it's policies really, but this is a big finding in the literature, that when the Black Lives Matter protests happened, when a bunch of police accountability movements spun up, mm-hmm. You know, that the reaction from police was often to reduce their crime saving efforts,
yep.
which ended up leading to more crime, right. which some people ended up blaming on BLM. I think it's more reasonable to blame it on, like, institutions that allow police to stop doing their jobs. But mm-hmm. whichever way you look at it, the impact of a bunch more police accountability movements and activism was to lead to more crime, no matter who you're going to blame in yeah. that context. And that, I think, in many respects, has created a current moment in our discourse that, like, people are really hostile to criminal justice reform efforts. Like, they're really, really yeah. hostile to it because they view the entire basket of things as moving together. They're so, like, oh, you just want leniency. So what you're saying is you want leniency for people, which means you want to help criminals. You're going to help criminals do more crime. You don't care about victims, et cetera. Right. And I guess, what is your reaction to these past 20 years yeah. of that shift? And what advice do you have going forward for people who really care about criminal justice reform?
Yeah. I think that's right. I do think we are, you know, the big increase in homicides and shootings after COVID, after George Floyd's murder, really did, I think, wake people. I think of it as a honestly just kind of like a stress test to the yeah. system, in a way that we stress test banks. And we failed the stress test, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like our systems were not equipped to handle the changes in criminal behavior. And suddenly there were, you know, cities were a lot more dangerous. I think, you know, the standard two sides on criminal justice policy, like what you'll see on cable news, are you've got the far left who want to defund the police and abolish prisons, and mm-hmm. they basically only care about the harms of the system.
Mm-hmm.
They're not thinking about the cost of crime to communities. Mm-hmm. And then you've got the far right that wants to lock everybody up at the first sign of moral weakness and just, like, throw away the key. And so they care only about public safety and not at all about the harms of the system. And clearly, both public safety and the harms of the system should matter. Those yeah. are both costs that we should be thinking about. And I think most people look at those, like, the 5% over here on the far left and the 5% on the far right, and they're like, those are our options? Like, the mm-hmm. middle 90% of America is like, that's what you've got for us? Like, yeah. I have to choose one of those?
So, I mean, both you and I are believers in the ability of policy to make people's lives better. Mm-hmm. Clearly, I mean, and in your book, you showcase, like, many different, even small ones, like the court text reminder. So, mm-hmm. like, the idea that the courts should text people
yeah.
When they're supposed to come to their hearings, mm-hmm. rather than just assuming that they'll read the fine print of every single document they receive in the mail, has, like, huge impact on whether people just show up to their hearings or not, yeah. which indicates that they're not, like, trying to avoid court. They just need some sort of
right.
reminder here. I mean, these are small things. things that can like have pretty big impacts on people's lives and whether the court system is functioning well, how much money's being spent. But when people are often thinking about like the grand, you know, course of how much crime is happening in their community, mm-hmm. it's often not a result of like these smaller policy choices, right? Like it's often like bigger things that are going on, like the big crime wave in the 90s and then the come down, and then again at post-COVID, the massive amounts of crime that we're seeing, the disorder. I mean, it's these are almost macro trends that occur across jurisdiction, across policy spaces. Of course, the baseline you're at matters a lot. So if you're already doing a lot of the good things, like maybe crime goes up, but you're going from like, you know, 10 murders to 20 murders rather than from 300 to 400. And that's a huge difference.
Yep.
But how do you think about that in your job? Because as an economist, like you're not just evaluating, you know, this specific policy, does it reduce it by 40%? It's like, well, if that's saving two lives versus the big cost to society and the hundreds of people being murdered due to handguns or whatever it is, like it almost feels like, well, where are we putting our attention? So how much of crime can actually be reduced by these policy shifts versus there's actually like bigger forces that we need to address?
Yeah. In some ways, this is the tension between sort of like the incrementalist approach to policy versus the like structural reform approach to policy, right? And I come down very firmly in the incrementalist camp. Like I think, and that's just for honestly, just like really pragmatic reasons. Like we need to be able to like answer the question of like, what do we do next? Mm-hmm. Like what should policymakers do about this? And yes, it might be great from a broader perspective to like eliminate poverty and, you know, make sure everyone has a high school degree and gets a good education and like has all the healthcare they need and all of that probably would reduce crime quite a bit. I have no idea to get from where we are today to that, that utopia.
Yeah.
And so it always drives me crazy when people say like, well, forget your incremental reforms. We have to actually just like make these big structural reforms to the system. That's actually what's going to like eliminate or reduce crime. And my response is always like, great. Like no one's stopping you. Go do it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't see a path there. So I'm going to work over here. And it's not just, but it's also not just because like, you know, one could imagine then getting trapped in a world where just like looking under the street light because like this is what we have as our options. I think what I try to walk through in the book is these incremental kind of often small seeming interventions do have effects that are sometimes on the order of 7 to 10%, sometimes on the order of 40 to 50%. And if you're able to shrink the number of people that are going through the system by 10 to 40% at each stage, that's going to add up really fast. And so I guess my perspective on this is, yes, any one of these policies would have an impact based on the evidence that we have. But what if you tried all of them, right? What if you did all of this stuff throughout the system? You're going to see gains kind of pile up. And then as you're reducing, you know, the number of people that are cycling through the system, it's just going to get bigger and bigger. And so I'm really optimistic that it's not necessarily like this specific set of policies. It's more of a pitch to like just change our approach to figuring out how to solve problems.
Mm-hmm.
Like instead of going in with an overall worldview and saying, well, we just have to be harsher on people, assuming that whatever it is that we're trying is probably not going to work, but keeping our eye on the ball of like, we need to solve, like, we're trying to reduce crime. Did this reduce crime? No. Okay. Stop doing that. Try something else.
Yeah.
Like having that mental shift, like that's how we're going to find the big solutions to our problems.
I agree with you that like, you know, if you are, especially because you are advising state lawmakers all the time on, you know, what should you do literally this session as you are writing bills? And like in that case, it's like, yes, you should focus on the known policies where you're failing and you could reduce the cost of the system. There are people committing murder, like whatever. Those are the most important things.
Yeah.
But the question I have is just, you know, I'm not sure I fully understand what is making crime go up and down in such large swings. Like, for instance, like I understand that like there are ways that you could make things better on the margins here in ways that are, and I don't mean that in a marginal way, like, they have huge impact on our safety and people's lives. But just like, why did crime come down in the last couple of years? Like, did people do that? Like, did policymakers do that?
Yeah, I think the honest answer is we don't really know, and it's probably a bunch of stuff. And so, I mean, this is true for the, you know, the crime wave in the late 80s, early 90s, when crime started falling in the mid 90s. We still don't know, fully understand why that happened. And so I think that's what was so scary when crime started increasing after COVID or during COVID. Mm-hmm. Because we didn't really understand why crime fell, like maybe that was temporary. And mm-hmm. this is actually the beginning of a long run crime wave. And then crime started falling again. So we're okay, we're all right. But I think part of it is, at least the most recent wave, the current hypothesis tends to be, well, you have more eyes on the street mm-hmm. when your people are not all home because of a pandemic. And so that, you know, just having people out and about is helpful for reducing crime, deters crime. You have cities that are throwing a lot of money around. You mm-hmm. have federal dollars coming in. You have CVI groups that are out there where the evidence is thinner than we would like there, but perhaps they played a role too. During the 90s, it's, you know, everything is on the table from some of the interventions that we actually tried, like intentionally, like hire more police, have put people in prison. But some of it's, you know, we took lead out of gasoline 18, 15 years earlier. And so those kids are growing up and now they're less violent. Mm-hmm. The war on poverty is paying dividends, and like the next generation is growing up and they're better yeah. off than their previous generations had been. And so I think this is just the nature of looking at these broader crime trends. Mm-hmm. It's like I compare it to someone asking, you know, what's making the stock market go up and down? And I'll say like, well, I don't know, but I can tell you how to make your business profitable, right? It's just like a different, you can't control those big macro swings. Of course, we'd all love to have the answers about exactly what was happening, but the reality is it's probably just a bunch of stuff that was going on. And so if we can, at the micro level, control, you know, pay as much attention to all of the inputs as mm-hmm. we can, that will have macro consequences. And I do strongly believe we're not just like, you know, we have some control over our destiny here.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, I think the macro economy example is actually a good one because, I mean, on recessions, like there are fewer recessions now because we're getting better at macroeconomic management. Mm-hmm. And there's a time period where like, and that doesn't invalidate all the people who are working towards like making people's businesses more profitable. Mm-hmm. Like, these are just both two important things to work on.
Yep.
I think I worry about this in economics because I think that like, you know, to use the metaphor you were using earlier, I think there's like because there's so many obvious failures happening at the state and local level in policymaking yeah. on policing, like just easy ways that you could just improve what's going on for everyone, like positive sum, like there's almost like yeah. no trade-offs, right. You just do it.
Yes.
Like everyone wants to focus on that versus mm-hmm. like, I'm not really clear that like people are helping us explain the actual broad reasons why so many people die in the United States. And like, maybe it's obvious, like maybe everyone feels like, okay, well, if we just had fewer guns, but that's just like a values thing, we have many guns mm-hmm. in this country, there's a lead thing, I think there's like a mm-hmm. lot of things where like perhaps policymakers could speed things along. Like, you guess you can't get rid of all recessions forever, but like mm-hmm. we do have fewer recessions now.
Yep.
So I wonder if like macro crime policy yeah. like should there be more of that?
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I do think you know, I think a lot about now as I'm in a philanthropy mm-hmm. and that does this policy work, and the theory of change on the funder side is very much like we're the ones who have the power and opportunity to take lots of risks.
Yeah.
Right. Like we can be out there trying funding, you know, 20 crazy ideas in the hopes that one actually pans out mm-hmm. and the government cannot do that. Right. Or is generally not doing that. And so we are always thinking about like, what are the moonshots? Like, mm-hmm. what are the things that like, it's a really low probability, but man, if that worked, it'd be transformative. And a lot of those kinds of plays are not the, well, maybe let's just help police recruit
yeah.
differently. Like, we're working on that too. Like, that seems mm-hmm. like, would be useful if we could figure it out, and we need some experimentation there. But the stuff I get most excited about are like GLP-1s as a potential treatment for addiction. Like, yeah. man, the anecdotal and descriptive evidence so far suggests that could be really powerful. Mm-hmm. If that works, that's
a game changer
in the public safety space, right? The other place where we're involved is on lead abatement. Mm-hmm. And there, you know, figuring out, okay, how do we help all the cities dig up their lead pipes and replace them faster, or make sure their water is the right pH so that the lead isn't leaching in or whatever. That's kind of, it's like, a slow and steady, very technocratic problem, mm-hmm. and like you need a lot of technical assistance or something, not the best place for a philanthropy to come in. But the place where we really do need some innovation is around the testing mm-hmm. of the blood tests. Like the blood tests for lead exposure are terrible. They're really noisy. They're really invasive. Like you don't want your small kid having this like invasive blood draw. And so most states don't mandate it. Most kids that are required to get these tests because they're on Medicaid don't get, or a lot of them don't get them. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, okay, how do we improve the testing so that we have better data about who's exposed, so that we can then address the underlying problem, but also get those kids treatment, because there mm-hmm. is treatment you can get. And so we're trying to, we're working with Renaissance Philanthropy to come up with basically a prize, an innovation prize for better lead tests. And so like, that's another place where it's just like, we just need some like technical mm-hmm. innovation in a way that could potentially be a game changer. Mm-hmm. So those are the kinds of ideas that I find most exciting. And again, it's like, let's go try some stuff, see what works. Most of it won't, but some of it will.
Mm-hmm. So one of, a lot of policymakers listen to this podcast. And one area that I think that people have, I think, maybe underrated in recent years is the ways that you can improve people's employment prospects in after they've been either interact with the criminal system, they've been in jail, like whatever it mm-hmm. is. In your book, you go over a lot of research in this space. Like, what are like the ways that policymakers who want to make sure that people can get jobs after becoming an offender, what should they do?
Yeah. So this is much easier said than done, it mm-hmm. turns out. There's been a lot of policy effort in this space, a lot of movement building in this space over the past decade or so, which is wonderful. You know, it's an important issue, but most of our policy changes in this space have failed. Mm-hmm. Thinking specifically of ban the box policies and clean slate policies, these essentially, try to address the problem of knowing that a lot of employers are reluctant to hire people with criminal records. And so hiding that information either entirely in the case of clean slate, or until the end of the hiring process after a conditional offer has been made in the case of ban the box. And so the idea is to kind of get people's foot in the door and get an interview and all of that. And it turns out that doesn't change employers' incentives. Employers still care if someone has a record, but now that they can't ask, they just try to guess, and then they discriminate against young Black men.
Yeah.
And so it's not only not helping, it's actually making things worse for a group that is already struggling in the labor market. And so as an economist, the way I think about addressing this problem is like, let's figure out what employers are worried about and directly address those concerns. Mm-hmm. Because this is probably, when we think about discrimination in general, there are a few different reasons that someone might discriminate. One is what economists call animus, that they just like don't like someone with this characteristic. I don't like someone who breaks the law. They're just like, I don't want anything to do with me. It's just a values thing.
Yeah.
That's really hard to address. That's really difficult. But the other reason is what we'd call statistical discrimination, mm-hmm. where what I really care about is employers. They're going to show up on time every day, going to do a good job, not get arrested anytime soon. Mm-hmm. So they're going to show up again tomorrow.
Not going to steal.
Not going to steal from me. Right. And I view a criminal record as a negative credential.
Yeah.
It's a signal that this person probably will do these other things that are really hard to observe in a job interview. And if that's the case, then we can help solve the problem by providing more of the information about what employers actually wish they could see. Mm-hmm. And then they won't care about the criminal record anymore, because if you can give them information that says, well, here's a reference saying this person's really reliable, mm-hmm. they, you know, went through this rehabilitation program, so they're not hanging out with these bad people anymore, you know, just whatever it is, then this could reduce the discrimination. So one of the things that has come up in one of the options that's come up in some studies here is thinking about insurance. Mm-hmm. So employers talk a lot about the risk associated with hiring someone with a record. They're worried about them stealing from them. They're worried about them committing another crime on the job. And that could be potentially catastrophic risk for the business owner. And so it's like, all right, well, how do we handle risk? We insure against it. We have mm-hmm. an insurance product. And it turns out the federal government has actually worked on this. There's a program called the Federal Bonding Program. The mm-hmm. Department of Labor has run since the 1960s. No one's ever heard of it. It's very, it's like bizarrely tiny. I think there are a few reasons it's just not worked. And some mm-hmm. of it's just the way it's administered. Maybe it's also just there's no marketing. But my team has been trying to think about, like, okay, how can we design an insurance product that would actually be functional here? Mm-hmm. And part of the challenge might just be that, because then the next question is like, well, why does the private market just solve this problem if there's demand for this? And so part of the issue is insurers just might genuinely not know how to price the risk.
Yeah.
So that's a place where philanthropy could come in and help make that market. The other possibility is just, you know, there might be, there could be a market, but an owner, business owners are just not willing to pay whatever that price is. Mm-hmm. But the positive externalities on the community, if
really
business owners are willing to hire this person and give them a job and help them, you know, get on a better path, would be high enough that actually there's a strong justification for government to subsidize that insurance. And so, yeah, this is just an area I'm really interested in, because I do think that finding ways to directly address these concerns is going to be much more productive than treating business owners as like the enemy in this conversation. It's like business owners are like the most rational actors, right? It's like they're just trying to make a profit. Like if we can adjust the incentive slightly so they can make it a profit while also doing things that we want them to do with high social returns, we're all better off. So
I love that. I mean, like, you know, you write in the book that the insurance covering up to $5,000 raises hiring managers' willingness to hire people with records by 12 percentage points, which is comparable to an 80% wage subsidy.
Yeah.
I mean, that is like
huge.
Huge. And it's also just like governments are currently spending money trying to subsidize this in an ineffective and very costly way.
Yes.
And insurance, I think, you know, you framed it, I think, in a really interesting way at the end of your question answer there. But it treats the business owners as part of a community solving a problem, not as like these are the people who we're trying to beat into submission to do something against their will. And I think that just changes the conversation too at a political level and a local way too.
I think it's common in this policy space to view private market actors as the enemy.
Yeah.
It's like, well, it's capitalism is why we have high incarceration rates. It's because of the private prisons. It's because, you know, business owners won't hire people with records. It's like as soon as you have a profit motive, we no longer trust you. You're out there just like for nefarious ends. And I think this is a place where economists just have a completely different view of it's like markets. If we're able to harness market forces, that is a really powerful and scalable way to solve problems. And we all are responding to incentives all the time. Mm-hmm. Public prisons also have strong financial incentives, right? It's everyone is responding to incentives. So it's not as if those with a profit motive are the only ones with incentives they're responding to. So paying attention to what the incentives everyone is responding to all the time can help us figure out how to tailor the solutions.
So a little less than a year ago, I was called in for jury duty, and it was actually my first time being called for jury duty. I think I've moved a lot, and so they can never get me. But DC people are called all the time because it's just small jurisdiction. And I got called for jury duty, and it was for a pretty like serious crime. It was for the murder of like a teenage boy. I think he was 13 or 14 years old. But the defendants were also kids themselves. Not all of them, but they were all like, you know, young teens to early 20s. I think the oldest was 21. And I remember, I mean, it's a really jarring experience when it's that I was not on the jury. I was in a panel that I got up. I didn't mean to get up, but they let me off because I had too much travel, and it was like a 4-month jury.
Oh my gosh.
It was going to be insane. But, you know, I was sitting in that courtroom, and I was just thinking to myself, and I was like, okay, like, if they end up convincing me that these men, who I think they were found guilty, were guilty of murdering this boy. Mm-hmm. The thing that's stressing me out is that, like, the choice is now, do I put them in, like, a torture prison? Which, you know, or do I, like, allow people who have, like, murdered a child to, like, go? You know what I mean? And it was, like, difficult for me. And in the moment, I was like, the thing that's causing me stress is, like, how bad the prisons are in D.C. Yeah. And that if I was, like, okay, a prison is a safe place where you are incarcerated, you're experiencing your punishment, you're deterred from future crimes, but you're not gonna, like, you're not risk of, like, sexual assault, you're not risk of being beaten by other people, you don't have, like, you're not losing your health, you're losing your health care that you need or whatever it is, and you have just basic level of decency and dignity being afforded to you, I would no longer feel so stressed about the possibility of being
likely to convict.
Yes, I'd be more likely to be like, okay, it's okay to convict this person, because it's like, I'm looking at the, I mean, you're witnessing these defendants in the room, it's like, they look like children, like, they're so young, and you're like, am I about to do this? And again, the question is not like, you know, obviously I think that, like, if someone is guilty, you should convict them and find them guilty. And I think that I would have done that if I was convinced of the evidence.
Yeah.
But it was like such a difficult moment for me being in that courtroom because it was like, I can't actually change the thing that would make me more likely or more comfortable with the choice I'm now being presented with. And so I've become very interested in prison reform efforts. I know this is something that you're working on a lot at AV too.
Mm-hmm.
What are ways that we can make prisons better? Like, are there things, what could we do?
Yeah. First, I just want to say there is research on this, especially from like my favorite paper on is an economic history paper during basically using the American Revolution as part of a natural experiment.
Oh my gosh.
The UK used to ship their convicted offenders mm-hmm. off. And it was essentially a death sentence. And so juries knew that. And then suddenly they couldn't ship them over to the Americans anymore because of the American Revolution. And so they had to just like sit in the ships in the port.
Mm-hmm.
And it was basically just like, you're in prison now. And then conviction rates went way up.
Wow.
So it's exactly this experience that you
I'm
had.
Not alone.
which I think is also just interesting because as we think about, if we do make prisons less harsher and or less harsh and make sentences shorter, mm-hmm. then we might actually see conviction rates go up and more people being sent to prison, which is just would be one of those unintended consequences, but might be better for policy and consequences. So working on thinking about how do we use prison and jail as an intervention point that actually puts someone on a better path.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it's separating it from this conversation about how much retribution does someone deserve.
Yeah.
But if we care about is achieving public safety, the sort of worst case scenario is that all we can do is just, this is just a holding pen. We're literally just keeping this person in a box so that they do not harm the community anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just like waiting for them to grow up.
Yeah.
Essentially. Like that's like, prison is effective at that, but that's a really expensive intervention if that's all we can get from it. And so, and we know that, you know, the sentences don't have much of a deterrent effect. And so that's out. So if we can use prison in a way that also has some sort of rehabilitation component, and there are a ton of programs in prison, like prisons are already trying to do this, but not always very effectively. How can we help them be more effective? So some of it is just like test the program, see if they're working. Some of the innovations are a bigger step. So AV is funding a bunch of randomized trials of essentially Scandinavian style prison units in different prisons around the country. And it's not all like blue states, right? It's like Pennsylvania, South Carolina, Missouri. It's like, you know, basically prisons at this point are so understaffed and they're violent. They're, you know, and that reduces the staffing even more. It's just this vicious cycle. Leaders in these institutions are saying like, something's got to give, we'll try anything, right? And so coming in with these different types of prison units where people are not locked down in their cells 23 hours a day, they have an opportunity to like cook for themselves. There's more of a collaboration or more collegial relationship between the guards and the inmates. It's just a setting where everyone who's locked up has more responsibility, as well as opportunity to sort of use their time wisely and make the community work. There's also a Netflix show called Unlocked that I love, where it's like they do this not in the same sort of like RCT style that we're running in these other prisons, but just from the same perspective of like, this is the status quo we're in is completely unsustainable.
Yeah.
We have to try something. And so we're just going to like unlock the doors. Like you all can come out. The guards are going to go away. We'll be watching you on cameras, but like it is your responsibility to make this community work.
I can't believe this really happened. It's like so shocking to me.
It's
like,
amazing.
Literally inmates running the asylum.
Totally. Totally. And so the first time I watched it, it was like made it partway through the first episode. And I was like, wait, I thought this was a documentary. There's no way this is true. Like how'd they get the cameras in there?
Yeah.
But it totally was like they were going to film it for some other reason. This one was in somewhere in Georgia.
Okay.
They just came out with a second season, which also blew my mind. Like, wait, they did this again in Arizona. And so I've just started the second season. But I mean, what I like about the series, they do a good job of saying like, this is not all like rainbows and ponies, right?
Yeah.
Like this is like, these people are complicated. They have a lot of real problems. And this is also not going to work for everyone. Like there are some people who cannot handle that level of freedom and they need to be taken out. So we do need to have like another unit where people have a little bit more restriction. But in the end, you know, spoiler alert, they continue, it they deem it a success and expand the program. And they had a second season. Mm-hmm. And these are the kinds of conversations we're having with a lot of departments of corrections, a lot of state leaders who are like, this is just, you know, no one wants to be a corrections officer. Our prisons are dramatically understaffed. They're incredibly violent. It's just only getting worse. Like, we have, like, what can we do? There's got to be something where we can do. And so necessity is the mother of invention, as they say. So we're getting a lot of creative solutions out of that.
And I just love, this is another place where, like, you're just so clear that there's, it's just a positive sum.
Yeah.
Area. Like, they're like, corrections officers get better off. It's better for prison costs. Yes. It's better for the prisoners. It's better for society. I mean, like, it's like, it's in an optimistic tone. That's like, that's great. And a pessimistic means like things are so bad that there things are like tons so bad. Of positive solutions.
There are tons of free lunches out there we could be seizing. I think, you know, one example of this is in Pennsylvania, where there is a little Scandinavia unit in one of the prisons. The corrections officers loved working in that unit so much that they've expanded the program to, or they're expanding the program elsewhere in Pennsylvania because there's demand from the officer side. Mm-hmm. It's like the jury's still out on the inmate side, right? We're waiting for the research results. But like, just from a workforce perspective, like, this is just it's a more meaningful place to work. People feel like they're actually helping people. They're not just showing up and like, fearing for their lives every day.
Yeah.
And it's just a better job. And so that's really interesting. Like, that's where the conversation is such where, you know, we have corrections officers and, you know, the families of the incarcerated side by side, like asking for these changes.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, you know, things are really bad when we get there, but it is a huge opportunity.
Yeah. Well, Jen, this is always our last and final question. What is an argument you've come across recently that you disagreed with?
So, as we were talking about earlier, the conversations around surveillance are you know, coming up a lot now as technology is improving. AI is making more things possible. And I think, you know, I'm seeing more and more articles about how, like, we should not have license plate readers, we should not have cameras, all of these things. And I just, to go back to our earlier conversation, I really hope that people think about the public safety benefits that these tools can bring.
Yeah.
These can be designed in a way that really have have minimal privacy costs, but really big public safety benefits. And I think these kinds of arguments are just really appealing because you can paint this crazy Big Brother picture and imagine all kinds of nefarious actors getting a hold of your data. And it doesn't have to be that way. And we have control over that as citizens. So this is just a place where I hope people don't go too far down that rabbit hole and aren't too persuaded by the crazy dystopian scenes that people are painting, because there is a real public safety upside to what technology is allowing now.
I am I'm largely with you, and in large part because I think there's a lot of lumping going on here where people are saying, well, can you have speeding tickets do the job of traffic enforcement? And like, that's not the same thing as like, you have to upload every single bit of your DNA to a database every morning. Like, I mean, like, it's just like not really, these are all together. You can take pieces of this that you 100%. Feel comfortable with. I do wonder, have you felt, I have been more open to the concerns of the Big Brother people during the Trump administration, the second Trump administration, because you're like witnessing now an administration that's more willing to kind of go against the courts, being more willing to kind of make decisions for what they say, you know, is public safety or for immigration enforcement that often are against the majority values of the country. And that's made me a little bit more like, well, I'm now taking a second step, thinking, well, if this administration has this tool, how concerned am I? Has that shifted you at all?
I think it reminded me a lot of, you know, I have a lot of libertarian friends and they have for a very long time been making arguments like this. Like, imagine, like, you always have to, whatever leeway you're giving to the government you like, imagine the other side in control and having access to that. And I just, so in the current moment when perhaps different government actors are overstepping or stepping farther than we would like, I always remember those warnings that my libertarian friends gave me, you know, 10 years ago. But I think this is just so yes, I think it is if people are worried about this, it's more reason to be paying real attention to, like, what are the rules governing all of the data collection. Frankly, our government agencies are not very good at this. Tech procurement is not, doesn't go well, right? I mean, most of these decisions are made by, like, local police departments. They, their vendors are coming to them every day with a new tool. They don't really know what works. They don't know what the difference between, like, owning the data and managing the data is, right? They're just kind of trusting the vendors and seeing what the other departments are doing. So figuring out some way to help give the decision makers the knowledge they need to make smart decisions about, like, where to draw the line, who has access, how long is the data retained, all that stuff would be really nice. So I think all the conversations in the current moment are reminding me of that. But I still, I mean, I also am, I've just personally have never been that much of a privacy hawk. Like, I love that Instagram shows me ads for things that I actually do want now that I see it and know it exists, right? Like, I love that the internet knows what I,
increasing my consumer surplus.
100%. And so, and I'm also like, I'm a woman, I live alone, right? Like, I like knowing that there are cameras a lot of places. If anything happened to me, it'd be much easier to figure it out today than it was in the 80s, right? Yeah. Like, I like that Uber can track and know, you know,
where I'm going,
all those things. Like, that makes me feel safer. And the data backs that up, right? Yeah. And so I just, everything comes with trade-offs. And so I think we just, figuring out how to capture the good and minimize the bad should be our goal here.
So, name of this episode, Everything Comes with Trade-Offs. Jennifer Doliak, your book is out this month, The Science of Second Chances. It was a great read. Thanks for coming on the show.